Case number 07-7165, Charles Royale, Appellant versus National Association of Letter Carriers, AFL-CIO. Mr. Gagliardo for the appellant, Mr. Herman for the appellee.
Good morning. If it please the court, I'd like to just briefly state 5 points that I think are to be addressed this morning. The first, of course, is the threshold issue of jurisdiction. I've reserved 5 minutes on rebuttal. I don't know if the court prefers that I address the issue now or in rebuttal, since it's really in response to Mr. Herman's motion. But there are 2 quick points that I would make regarding this matter.
Why don't you address it? This is a motion to dismiss. Go ahead and make your points, but address it now, please.
More fully now. I will be glad to. The facts are not disputed. Within the statutory time limit, the same limit provided by the rule, the notice of appeal was filed with the clerk but was not docketed with the clerk of the district court. However, on that day, the district court did charge the fee and acknowledged receipt of the required fee to proceed with an appeal. Also, counsel for the appellee, the defendant below, was served on that day. It was not until sometime later, as stated in the briefs, that it was discovered that the notice of appeal had not been docketed, whereupon measures were taken and the district court clerk, nunc pro tunc, considered it docketed as of September 26th, that is, within the statutory time limit. The argument, the essential argument that I make in the briefs and that I suggest and submit to you again today, is that the appellant can't be held responsible for actions beyond his control. And what was at issue here were not his actions, but the actions of the district court clerk. He did what he had to do. Yes, ma'am.
Can I just ask you, does it matter at all that the district court has promulgated these rules that say that on a notice of appeal, you're supposed to submit it, I think, on a PD and also a written copy, and that if you want to file it electronically, there's this complicated procedure you're supposed to follow?
I don't think so, because I think it's an either or. Either compliance with either one constitutes, or filing under either system constitutes a filing. And the fact...
So I guess I didn't make it clear. In other words, you filed electronically.
Yes.
But it wasn't fully consistent with the local rule. Does it matter, is what I'm getting at.
Well, not if the Phoenix case that the Second Circuit decided is what will be followed here. As I'm sure the court knows, in the Second Circuit said in Phoenix that it's within the province of the court to excuse what I would call technical noncompliance. My understanding is, though, that and it does fall personally to me, that I did fully comply with the rules and did make a good filing.
So this is more like the Seventh Circuit case where the judge suggested that the electronic system essentially is like the clerk in the clerk's office, and it's the clerk's error that's at issue here?
Yes, Your Honor, that's correct. In fact, I said in my brief that it's no different than if we had strictly a paper system and the clerk had dropped the paper on the floor and didn't realize it until sometime thereafter or misfiled it, and sometime thereafter you realized what had happened and then went ahead and docketed the notice of appeal. I'd like to address, and I did in the reply brief, what the case that Mr. Herman cited from the Supreme Court, and I submit to you that it is not controlling, because for exactly the reasons that you've just been asking me about, Judge Rogers. That is, it's the clerk's error, not the appellant's error, that the appellant did everything that the appellant had to do and was required to do, and that, unlike the Supreme Court case where the appellant did not do, albeit in reliance on a court order, but the appellant did not act within the statutory 14-day period, whereas in this case, I submit to you that Mr. Royale, through me, in fact did act as he was required to do within the 30-day statutorily required period. I think that...
And your opponent was served that day, is
That is correct. I really think that the issue is, I don't want to say that simple, but it's that concise. I think those are the arguments, pro and con, and I suggest that we indeed are properly before this court, that the court does have jurisdiction, and that the merits of the appeal should be addressed. So if I may turn to that for a moment. I think there are four key points regarding whether or not it was error to grant summary judgment to the defendants. First of all, we all know, and it's axiomatic, that what really is being investigated and what the plaintiff is charged with proving in this case is what was the employer's intent at the time that he was discharged. Was it discriminatory or was it not? And therefore, it really doesn't matter when the employer comes in and says, I have a single reason or I have multiple reasons why I took the action. The real question is whether those proffered reasons are true or whether they're pretextual. Now, that's as basic employment discrimination law as one can possibly state. And what I submit to you is that if you look at the totality of circumstances, these reasons that the employer proffers could not have been the motivating reasons at the time the termination decision to terminate and the action of termination took place. And I point to several factors. One, and it's not disputed, Mr. Royale was not warned, counseled, or disciplined in the normal course of things regarding these events. Now, it's just human nature that mistakes are made. Nobody is perfect. And an employer doesn't immunize itself from a discrimination claim by saying, aha, you see, we've pointed out that this employee wasn't perfect. One really has to go back and say, is that what you were thinking? Is that what you knew? Is that what you said at the time the alleged poor performance occurred? And this is equally or even more important, at the time you terminated the employee. Mr. Royale was not given reasons why he was terminated. He was simply let go. No, he wasn't, and I understand how that might create an inference that, maybe he hadn't passed muster. But what is not disputed, Your Honor, and I don't mean am I cutting you off? I don't mean to.
Well, what I was saying is, normally in a probationary period, which he was at will, right?
Right.
In a probationary period, you might not have to do the counseling. I mean, that lets you say, this guy is just not working out.
It's not a question of what's required. It's a question of what did the employer do, and is there enough for a jury to reasonably infer that the proffered reason is pretextual? Again, I'm stating axiomatic principles. So the real question is it a certainty? Because in order to grant summary judgment, it would have to be beyond the pale for a jury to make the leap on a reasonable basis that the proffered reason isn't true. So again, you look at the totality of circumstances, and what I'm suggesting in this case is that nobody takes measures against him, and if these violations are as serious as they are, and we did admit that there were two errors on his part, and one can say, they alleged errors, he admitted those errors, end of analysis. And I suggest, no, that's only the beginning of the analysis. The analysis is, did the employer really consider these errors, which in this case were late payment of taxes and the imposition of small penalties as a result, were they considered significant by this employer to justify in whole or in part a discharge? And one would say then, if they are that important, somebody would have said, must have said something at the time. And the evidence is that wasn't done. Therefore, the question can go to the jury. Do you really think they fired him because of the late payment of taxes, or do you think it was simply pretext for discrimination? Now, I add a third component to that, and that third component, and I think it's critical, is the fact that many of the performance deficiencies that are alleged against Mr. Royale involve employment records, payroll records, tax records, records which have to be kept for legal and other reasons. Remarkably, the testimony by the employer's representative, Mr. Sclafani, is we had those records but they were taken or they have disappeared from a locked storage cabinet in the basement of our headquarters. That is such an implausible story as to give rise to an inference that it's an excuse. And I cited a case in the brief saying that when it can be shown that an employer is actually lying about a reason, it creates a stronger inference of pretext and therefore allows a jury to reasonably infer that the true motive is discriminatory. And I don't have to remind the court that it doesn't matter if this is a weak case or a strong case, it only matters that there's a matter of fact that has to be determined by a jury. I want to address briefly the issue of Mr. DeLeo as a comparator, and I addressed this in the reply brief more fully. The district court looked at DeLeo after he, let me set the predicate. Mr. Royale was an account manager. He was succeeded by Mr. DeLeo, who came from the information technology department. The district court focused on the fact that after DeLeo said that he couldn't do the job and asked to be he asked to go back to his old job, the employer allowed him to go back to his old job and says, well, there's a difference there. They're not similarly situated because DeLeo was a former employee who had a position. Royale was not did not have a prior job to which he could return. What I suggest is that what you really have to look at is how is DeLeo treated during the time he's performing as the account manager. And this ties back into the discussion we just had about are these reasons true, truly the motivating factors, or are they pretext? If DeLeo, by his own admission, can't do the job, how come DeLeo is not censored, questioned, sanctioned? Why is DeLeo allowed until he himself decides he doesn't want to do the job, rather than the employer taking affirmative steps to deal with the fact that he can't do the job? This, again, creates the inference that
what about the fact that they didn't help him either? You know, when your client was making these errors and you say he wasn't sanctioned, but he also wasn't helped, or he wasn't corrected.
But he also wasn't,
And this fellow wasn't corrected either.
And he wasn't fired. He was never removed. Let's leave firing aside. Removed from the job. Whether he's fired and put on the street or whether he's reassigned to his prior position is not material in this regard. What's material in this regard is that DeLeo is allowed to continue to function until he himself says, I can't do it, rather than somebody else making that determination. Yet it had to have been apparent to the employer that DeLeo was incapable. I mean, he wasn't trained. The only reason they hired him is because he had, according to them, some familiarity with the software that was used in the department.
He was there 2 months?
He was there, I think their brief says 1 or 2 months, yes.
And your client was there 6 months?
He was there from February till August, 6 months, a little bit less if you calculate the precise days. And the final point I'd like to address, and I see my time is almost up, Mr. Herman said, you know, the court never talked about same actor inference, and indeed that it didn't. And what I said in my brief is, though, it certainly implied. And in fact, the district court said we never challenged the fact that Mr. Young was both the person who hired and fired Mr. Royale. Well, that's patently not true. And I said in the footnote in the brief, you know, we said that in the material statement of disputed facts, and we said it also in the brief, and the district court merely missed that point. And the only reason I want to bring it up here is that to the extent the court thinks that this comes into play, and my research indicated that this circuit has not adopted a same inference rule, same actor inference rule, but in any event, it's Mr. Stubblefield who plays the key role on hiring and Mr. Sclafani in terms of the termination. So to the extent that anyone thinks that that's a factor or weight, I would say two things. One, it isn't, as a matter of fact. And two, even if it were, I cited the cases in the brief, it's a factual matter for the jury to decide, not something that should be decided on summary judgment. I see I have 25 seconds left, so I'll stop.
All right.
Thank you.
Mr. Herman?
May it please the court. First on the jurisdictional point. The electronic filing system that's used by the district court sends out an electronic, immediate electronic notification when something is filed. The local rule also states, and this is rule 5.4C, that the person filing a document by electronic means is responsible for ensuring the accuracy of the official docket entry generated by the ECF software. Now, no electronic notification was sent. I don't have personal knowledge. We don't have of what Mr. Gagliardo did, but it's beyond dispute that no electronic notification was sent out at the time he attempted to make this filing, and that the electronic filing is the filing. He was on notice, or he certainly should have been on notice, because he, like we, never received an electronic notification that the notice of appeal was filed in the district court. He then did nothing for virtually 2 months before contacting the district court about this.
Isn't there a guide, not in the rule, but in the manual that says notices of appeal have to be filed by paper? The local rules say that. They exclude notices of appeals from electronic filings.
I'm actually not familiar with that handbook that you're talking about, right. But in any case, he didn't do it by paper. He did it by electronics.
Yeah, I think it says that. But I have another question, which is, how is it that the district court rules can control what is a proper notice of appeal filing? Because the notice of appeal requirement comes from the Federal Rules of Appellate Procedure.
That's absolutely correct, and they must be filed in the district court within 30 days. And this was not done in this case, because the filing is the electronic filing in this case. It didn't happen. The plaintiff's attorney was on notice of that, and he could have cured it with a motion under Federal Rule of Appellate Procedure 4.A5, I believe, within 30 days.
But do you dispute that on the whatever day it was, the 26th of September 2007, that he made an electronic filing?
I have no idea whether he did or he did not make an electronic filing.
I suppose he did. I mean, if you're not disputing that, and you say you don't have any idea, and he's got the credit card charge, right?
He was charged the fee, but that's not the critical thing. The critical thing is filing under the statute.
I know that, but let's assume that he made that he did the electronic way. Does that mean you lose if we assume that in fact that happened?
I believe he did not make a successful electronic filing, and the local rule says that technical problems interfering with electronic filing do not extend statutory time limits for filing notice of appeals. And I agree with you. The statute is actually set by statute, as Your Honor is well
That's
aware.
That's the local rule of the district court.
Correct.
Yeah. Well, how does a district court get the authority to control the filing of a notice of appeal when it comes? I asked you this before. When the requirement comes from the Federal Rules of Appellate Procedure 3A,
Then the question is, what constitutes the filing, Your Honor? And that's something that the district court has to have a rule on, and it does in this case.
Well, something maybe the appellate court ought to have a rule on.
Well, maybe, but I don't believe the appellate court does have a rule or clarification on that point. And we submit, it really is a question of law, Your Honor. I certainly agree with that. The Bowles case says, Mr. Gagliardo cited the Phoenix case. That's a pre-Bowles case, this is not subject to equitable tolling.
If the district court routinely allowed electronic filing of notices of appeal, that's one thing. If the district court, under its handbook, routinely refuse to allow electronic filings of notice of appeal, that's another thing. But we don't have any idea from what goes on in the district court. Do they allow, despite the handbook, electronic filing? Do they refuse to accept electronic filing? I don't know.
They did not refuse to accept it, at least on a nunk-pro-tunk basis in this case.
Oh, I know that.
Apparently they don't insist on paper filing. I frankly don't know the answer to Your Honor's question.
Well, there are two separate guidances from the district court. One, I think, is the reference that Judge Randolph has that says notices of appeal cannot be filed under the CMECF system. All appeals should be filed with the clerk's office on a disk in PDF format and should be accompanied by a paper copy of the appeal. But then there's another guidance that tells you how you can file a notice of appeal electronically.
Yes. So, well, I admit it's confusing, Your Honor. It's certainly confusing to me, and it may be to the panel. Whatever it's you're supposed to do, he didn't do it in this case.
Just let me ask you, so I understand your position. Hypothetically, an attorney files a notice of appeal electronically in accordance with the district court procedure. Something goes wrong with the computer, so it doesn't spit out this electronic notice. Is the plaintiff out of court?
No, he's not out of court because there's a procedure in the Federal Rules of Appellate Procedure whereby he can make a motion to the district court.
No, my hypothetical is he's done everything correctly, but the machine malfunctions. He has no notice that the machine has.
Yes, he does have notice,
Your
Honor, because my point is that the electronic notice is generated by the ECF system to attorneys of record like Mr. Gagliotto and to me, for that matter. No. I was wondering what was going on. He certainly should have been wondering what was going on.
Well, you were served the same day, I thought. That was Judge Henderson's question.
I was served with a paper copy, but
right.
that is not the critical question for the statutory time limit.
Okay, but
serving the other side doesn't constitute the filing.
All right, the local rule that I just referenced, where does it say that a notice of appeal is deemed to be filed only upon issuance of this electronic receipt?
Well,
in other words, you say anyone would know, but where does the rule say that?
Well, I'm looking, Your Honor.
Okay.
I mean, I think if you look at the totality of Local Rule 5.4, which talks about the ECF filing of documents, which talks about the fact that the electronic filing constitutes the filing, that the person filing the thing is responsible for the accuracy of the docket record generated by the ECF software, and that service is actually completed by the electronic notification.
All right, but there's nothing about this if you don't get an electronic receipt acknowledging filing.
Well, I don't think that the electronic notice is actually...
Your argument was he had to know because he didn't receive this electronic notice of filing.
That is my
argument. But the rule doesn't say anything about that, is what I'm getting at.
Well, I mean, he certainly should have, at the very least, been put on notice that there was something strange going on.
Why?
Because every time there's a filing, electronic filing in the district court, you get the notice.
But the rule doesn't say anything about that. And suppose this is the first notice of appeal he's filed. I mean, it doesn't give any notice that your electronic filing shall not be deemed to have been filed unless you get this electronic receipt saying it's filed.
Well, it's not just an electronic receipt. It's actually the service of the electronic document.
You're saying a practitioner would know even though the rule is silent.
practitioner would certainly know, and in every other case of every paper that was filed in the district court with respect to this, there was such a notification sent out by the electronic things. It's immediate. We both got it. We both get them. But this didn't happen.
This is the first one for the notice of appeal.
This is the first document about the notice of appeal, you mean?
Yeah.
This is the first time that there was no notice sent out.
Now, I know some circuits take a strict view that if it's not on the docket, you lose. Your appeal is not timely filed. But the two circuits have done that, have not discussed this point, as I recall, that you're making. Rather, they've just taken a strict reading of the rule, no exceptions, and particularly post-Bowles, no equitable tolling of any kind. So it's an absolute jurisdictional rigid requirement.
Well, I think it is a jurisdiction. There's a way to cure it, though, which is Federal Rule of Appellate Procedure 4A5.
But let me ask you, in the old days, if you just handed your notice of appeal to the clerk in the district court's office, the clerk accepted it, and then went to lunch and forgot about it, and somehow it ended up in the waste paper basket, and it never got docketed. I mean, under those circumstances, do you lose your filing of an appeal?
I think that would present a different situation.
Well, the Seventh Circuit has taken the view that the electronic system is simply a substitute for the human clerk. And so if the electronic system makes a mistake, it's like when the human clerk makes a mistake. It doesn't penalize the plaintiff or whoever the appellant is.
I mean, I grant you, Your Honor, that this is not an entirely clear situation, but I do think that he knew or should have known and had an opportunity to do something about it at the time. He didn't do it in the statutory time passed. I notice that I'm running out of time here, and I do want to briefly address the questions on the merits of this case, unless Your Honor doesn't want to. Your Honor's the question, I mean, first of all, this is the question before on summary judgment is, could a reasonable jury on this record infer that Mr. Royale was terminated because of his race? And we submit that no reasonable jury could do that. Mr. Gagliardo made the point that it's a question of the employer's intent at the time he was employed or at the time he was terminated, and the record is replete, and Judge Walton's thorough opinion reviewed the overwhelming record that there was numerous contemporaneous complaints about Mr. Royale's performance, both from his supervisor, Mr. Stubblefield, from his subordinate, Ms. Neidlinger, from other officers of the union who were complaining, and from vendors. All of those are set forth in what we call 56.1 statement. You may call it Rule 7.1 statement down here. I'm just referring to New York, but I think you actually have a 56.1 rule also. All of those are clearly set forth in our 56.1 statement, supported by the record, and Mr. Gagliardo simply did not refute those in his response to those particular provisions. And I'd refer you to paragraphs 57, 58, paragraphs, and I would go through this in more detail, paragraph 21 of the 56.1 statement, paragraph 29, paragraphs 23 through 28, paragraph 39, and the responsive statements that he made. Now, he quibbles with some of these things. He said that some of these meetings were by telephone rather than in person, but that doesn't change the essence of what was going on. I want to just talk about the comment he made about Mr. I think it's self-evident that Mr. DeLeo is not similarly situated. It was not based on only two incidents. There was a wealth of record evidence of numerous incidents of complaints and that the union reasonably drew a union officials reasonably drew a conclusion that he was not adequately performing his job. I want to address the point about Mr. Sclafani and the so-called missing documents. This is set forth in at A280. That's the paragraphs that refer to this in the plaintiff's 56.1 statement. Talks about he testified that they disappeared from his office as well as from his locked storage facility. That's in the response to defendants, paragraph 44 at page A280. And if you actually look at the underlying record, which Mr. Gagliotto has not provided the court, but if you actually drill down to the underlying record, it's not Exhibit 27, as he says in his 56.1 statement, it's Exhibit 25. And the reference exhibit pages, the deposition of Sclafani says that Sclafani, was not making any claim that he had any knowledge of evidence of anything improper regarding state withholding taxes. And then there was the question about the documents. And the documents said they were in boxes and they were misplaced. But he never lied. Mr. Sclafani never said that there were errors that he knew about that he couldn't produce documents to prove. This was routine misplacing of files. It's not probative evidence of pretextual conduct. And in any case, Mr. Sclafani was not the decision maker. There's no evidence that any of this was known to Ms. Brondell, who was the Secretary of Treasury, or President Young, who were the people that made the decision to terminate Mr. Royale. And to try to impute something that wasn't alive by Mr. Sclafani to the decision makers, and to say that this was a lie that somehow taints the union's decision making is simply strains credulity, or it's simply incredible. And I guess I'm out of time, and unless the court has further questions.
I don't think so. Thank you.
Thank you.
Does Mr. Delaney have any? All right. Why don't you got 25 seconds. You can take a minute.
I thought I had reserved 5 minutes in rebuttal. In any event, if the local rule 5.4C says that the filing 5.4C3, any document, order, or notice filed or docketed electronically by the court or by the clerk shall have the same binding authority as one filed on paper. I think the confusion is, in the past, you couldn't file a notice of appeal electronically because they didn't have the credit card set up. You couldn't make a credit card payment. They've changed that. That's why you can now do it. I did receive an electronic notice from the court. It was attached to my motions paper, and it acknowledged that they had taken the filing fee. It says that a person filing is to assure the accuracy of the official docket entry, and that's what I did. When I kept calling, as I've stated in more detail, and found out that the record hadn't been transmitted, I found out that the reason that hadn't been transmitted is the failure to docket the notice that had been filed. And that's when the court docketed it, nunc pro tunc.
Thank you.
Thank you.